We want to say just a few things before we move on about the major differences between the church in the East and in the West. We have already talked about this a bit. First of all, concerning the government of the church, in the West, you come to have the recognition of the universal authority of the Bishop of Rome. In the East, the Bishop of Constantinople does not have that kind of authority. He vies with the Bishop of Moscow, and I recall our discussion of the third Rome the first Rome, Constantinople the second, and Moscow the third. So that whereas the Bishop of Rome came to have ascendancy in the West, the Bishop of Constantinople could not pull that off in the East. There is no single bishop with power in the East which corresponds to the Pope in the West. And so as it worked out, the highest authority in the East is the Council, not the Pope. That's the difference. Second, there are different liturgies, and I just mentioned that. I don't have time to explain all the differences or to go into the differences, but there's a different liturgy. Theology, there is general agreement, differences on small points. Ecclesiastical authority, in the East, only the first seven councils are recognized. And I give you that list in your addendum, if you've looked at it, and I indicate on those which are recognized as universal. That is, all the ecumenical councils, that is, the universal councils that took place before the break, are recognized as genuine, legitimate councils. The ones that were held after, the ones sponsored from the West that were held after the break, are not recognized. So the East does not recognize all the ecumenical councils. As far as the sacraments, there are slight differences in their views on the Lord's Supper and extreme unction. We'll just note that without going into it. We've already looked at the filioque cause in the Nicene Creed. That was a difference. In the East, the later dogmas concerning Mary, such as the Immaculate Conception, are not accepted. There's Mariolatry. In the Eastern Orthodox churches, doctrinal evolution pretty much stopped. That is, when the church split in 1054, the East and the West taught pretty much the same doctrines. The worship of Mary or the veneration of Mary had evolved in both East and West. However, you recall that the East sort of became reactionary, their liturgy and their theology became more fixed. They considered the ancient ways orthodox. They were less willing and less able to change. Of course, they had the problem with the Muslims later on. So that basically what happened was that the doctrine continued to evolve in the West. So now you have more refined dogmas concerning Mary, for instance. But this did not happen in the East. Very little doctrinal evolution after the break. Some, but not much. So the process continued in the West, did not continue in the East. As far as cooperation is concerned, and this looks down to our day, the Orthodox wing, the Eastern Church, enters into cooperative efforts, such as they belong to the National and World Council of Churches. The Roman Catholic will not. Just interesting, isn't it? That the Eastern Orthodox Church is a part of the World and National Council of Churches, which is primarily a Protestant movement. But the Roman Catholic Church does not. Minor differences between the church in the East and in the West, that is, just practice as opposed to theology. Priests may marry in the East, but not the bishops. You've already said that, haven't you? This is also the Anglican tradition, that you can get married, but once you're married, you can't ever be a bishop. So they still practice the older form of triune baptism in the East. I don't know how old that is. I didn't go back to New Testament time necessarily, but comparatively old. You know what that is, triune baptism. We've already talked about three versus two-dimensional images. There are some other minor differences which we're going to talk about later, but just to point out, I'm going to give a general picture of the other differences after the break. Well, that's the East. We come now to the West. What's happening in the West? Triune baptism, I'm going to use this mass since we've got the screen down. triune baptism is the triple immersion of infants, as well as adults. Infants, yes, they immerse infants. Look at the big picture in the West. First of all, I've just divided this up. From the Franks, we've already met the Franks, have we not? It's the most powerful, the Germanic or barbaric tribes. Look at the Franks from Clovis to the Viking invasions, 450 to 900. It's quite a long period of time. And we just make some general statements about this. Two powers emerge in the West. What has happened in the West is that the Roman Empire has disintegrated. Civilization was declining in the East, and the Muslim invasions changed everything. But in the West, the Dark Age is in. Two powers emerge when the you have in 476 you had the last official Roman emperor. See when did Rome fall? Well, you see, Romulus Augustulus, by the way, his name not in the syllabus, it was the name of the last Roman emperor. He was kidnapped by the barbarians, and that was the end of the. And Rome never had an emperor after that. Somebody said, well, that's the end of the Roman Empire. However, not quite that simple. You see, the problem with dating the fall of the Roman Empire is that if one empire comes in and vanquishes another, you can just put your finger right on the date. You can just, or within a few years. For instance, you can say, in other words, when the Persians fell to Alexander the Great, you can just, the years of the invasion, and that's when one empire replaced another. When the Persians overthrew the Babylonians. You can look at 432 and the fall of Persepolis and say, that's it. There's no great empire replaced Rome. It just sort of dwindled. As a matter of fact, Gibbon in his famous book, he dates the fall of the Roman Empire with the fall of Constantinople in 1453. Remember when it finally fell to the Turks, 1453? So how many years between the last Roman emperor, official, in the West, you see, and the fall of Constantinople in the East? 1,000 years. So when you say, when did Rome fall, it depends on whether you include the East and the West. When did Rome fall? When the Roman Empire fell. If you just say the West, you can say 476, the fall of Romulus Augustulus. But what about the East, you see? The capital had been moved to Constantinople. When did it fall? Well, the Muslims owned most of their territory. The city was still there, some of their territory, not very much. The city itself fell in 1453. You see the problem? It just depends on whether you include East and West and what you mean by falling. Well, anyway, but we are on safe grounds to say that high civilization was gone. And of course, one of the characteristics of a high civilization is that it is urban as opposed to rural. So two powers emerge, the Franks and the Roman popes. The Franks and the Roman popes. And the Lombards who settled in northern Italy, so here's the Franks up in Gaul, the word France gets its name from the Franks. And here's the Roman popes in central Italy, here's Rome. Well, northern Italy was the Lombards, right between the Lombards and, the Lombards are between the Franks and the Popes. And they exerted pressure on both, as I indicate. In 481, Clovis became the king of the Frankish people and founded the Merovingian dynasty. Now, it wasn't really an empire. It's an idea more than an empire. He was a nominal Roman Catholic. He expanded the kingdom with the help of the Catholic population, that is, in what used to be called Gaul. I just give a quick look here at society and institutions in the Merovingian age. Frankish Gaul, which is now France, between 450 and 490 witnessed the emergence of an early medieval culture resulting from the fusion of Roman, German, and Christian elements. Sort of a new thing. Let me teach you how to think about what's going on. It's very difficult for us to visualize it, isn't it? What's going on? Now, here's what's happened. You had the high civilization along the Mediterranean Sea. Okay? These barbarian tribes came in, And because the civilization was weakened by the time they got there, or they wouldn't have got in, and because they were essentially barbarian, that doesn't mean they were, you know, and I had a question on, you know, you talked about this. They were not, they wanted in on the civilization, basically. They didn't know how. And so what happened was that you had a society that was a little bit of barbarianism, a little bit of high civilization, and neither of them, and it was neither of them. It was right in the middle. For instance, technically, as on, in theory, it was fairly far advanced, but never did work. So what you had is a society that is now primarily rural. You see, now listen to me. Just you need to understand this, that when high civilization breaks down, the one thing you cannot do is live in town. What would you do? Suppose you lived in town, and all of a sudden you had no public transportation, no public utilities, but more important, your money wasn't any good. Strictly barter. Who's better off in a barter system? The fellow lives in town, or the fellow lives in the country? You see, you understand the ancient world that over 90% of the people were involved in raising the food to feed everybody. So we don't understand that because in our society, it's because of modern technology and fertilizers and machinery, a very small percentage of our of the people in the world or in America can feed the rest of us. Now, but if you didn't have that, what would happen? We say everybody has to sort of go in and do it for themselves. And so the person who owns land becomes the power. You see, in a cash society, he who's got cash controls it. But if your money isn't any good, only thing that's any good is gold. Nobody has much of that. You're back basically to a barter system, and you have to. Everybody has to sort of provide for their own food. Then land as well. You see that, can't you? Well, and so the cities became empty. We're going to see when Martin Luther comes to Rome and visits Rome. Rome is a dump. Pigs in the streets. Almost very few buildings that are not in ruins. It's filthy. Open sewers. This was Rome. This is the mighty city of Augustus. During this period, whole towns, large towns, towns with schools, even universities, became simply vacant. And whole areas of Europe that had been under the plow went back to the forest, and the wild animals took over. And so, does that help you understand what's going on? And so it becomes sort of every man for himself. The Saxons invaded Britain and destroyed Roman civilization. The Saxons invaded Britain during this period, but they were not converted. They were still strictly staunchly Teutonic. The Merovingian dynasty in France and stretching down to Italy was based on the theory of absolute hereditary authority. The kingdom was the private possession of the king, but it didn't work, as I've said. But you had church land. It was really very confusing. You had poor, by the way, one of the hardest things for us to understand is how hard it is to make civilization work without communications. Communication, simply knowing what's going on, knowing who is where, what they're doing, simply what's happening beyond your immediate vision. It's hard for us to think about that. Do you realize that for most of history, people up till 100 years ago, all over the world, for all places, nobody really knew what was going on, when it was going on. Now, we just kind of think about that. But because with our modern instant communication, it can happen on the other side of the world, and we can see a TV tape of it bounce off a satellite 3 minutes later, or in some cases, while it's happening. Pick up your newspaper and find out what's going on all over the world. For instance, one of the real problems of historians have in for instance, writing about ancient warfare. During almost all of ancient warfare, all the battles, nobody really knew what was going on while it was going on. And even after the Civil War, read Bruce Catton's The Silence of Appomattox, for instance, and see how the problem of Civil War, even with the telegraph, that a general would march his army off and there wouldn't be anybody there to fight, you know. One of the reasons that the You have Civil War battles, you know, and a whole regiment would just march off into the wilderness and not find anybody there. Why? Nobody knew where anybody was. They thought that, you know, the maps were any good. They didn't. They couldn't communicate with each other. It's just very confusing. Later on, we read about it, but you've got historians looking back on it and trying to reconstruct it. But it's very difficult to reconstruct. But who do you talk to? You talk to people who were there, but they didn't know what was going on while they were there. And they look back on it, you finally try to paste it together and make deductions. And that's why we don't hardly see this. Well, one of the reasons this system didn't work was under the Franks. The Franks were basically a barbarian people, nominally Catholic, trying to put together a civilization. And it just didn't work. For all kinds of reasons. Nobody knew what was going on. There was very little order. They had very little experience at that. Then the question was, who owned the land? See, if you have a landed economy now, away from the coin, back to the dirt, you got a problem. Who owns the land? Well, the Franks said, we own the land. But the church says, no, you don't. We own the land. And so you had the bishop claiming it and the count claiming it and fighting over it and disagreeing. Who owns the territory? And so he's a Roman Catholic. He says, that's mine. I conquered it. But he said, it belongs to the church, and you're a Catholic. Very confusing, as you can see. The Merovingian dynasty was weakened through the division of the kingdom by inheritance, and actual power fell into the hands of Charles Martel, about 720. He was the mayor of the palace, this title, and his descendants, Pepin and Charles the Great, or Charlemagne. And so Charlemagne it was the Holy Roman Empire, as it was called. You see, now keep in mind what's going on. This is the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne. The Holy Roman Empire was a theory. It was not actually an empire. What it was, in the simplest terms, was these Frankish barbarians, their descendants, trying to establish a civilization that emulated, as far as they could understand it, the old Roman system. But now it is not pagan Rome, it is Christian Rome. Remember, you see the hand of Augustine in this. Now, before it was the city of man, now it's the city of God. Before it was the pagan Roman Empire, now it is the Holy Roman Empire. And it has a new emperor. Who is it? Well, eventually, Charlemagne. And Charlemagne claimed much of this part of Europe. And it's called the Holy Roman Empire. But if you had actually been there, you would have seen that what you had was holy confusion and very little else. It never did work very well. It was always a theory. It was a Holy Roman Empire except for three problems. First of all, it wasn't holy. These people were still barbarian. Secondly, it wasn't Roman. It was Frankish. And third, it was never an empire. It was just a theory. It never could work. Never did work. Not very well. If you're interested in pursuing this, you can get a good history book and read about the Holy Roman Empire. I'm just giving you the overview because of our time. You see that? Other than being unholy, un-Roman, and not an empire, it was the Holy Roman Empire. But do you see what they're trying to do? These are barbarian people trying to establish the city of God. A Roman Empire to replace the one that fell, the one under the headship of the church, or of God anyway, as opposed to a pagan Roman Empire. Well, that's very... I apologize to you for not dealing with that any better, but time forbids us to, you know... First, you can go to a college and take just a course, say nothing but the Holy Roman Empire in graduate school. But you can... that sort of gives you an idea of something that it was. We look next at the coming of the Northmen. The Carolingian Empire decayed because of its internal weaknesses, I indicate here, and this process was speeded up by other barbarians from further north. The farther north you went, the more barbarian they got. And the Northmen, people from the Scandinavian countries, not on our map here, I should be using that map over there. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland came swooping down, and for years it became a part of the tradition that they would harry the coastline. Remember Hagar the Horrible in the funny papers? He gives out every day and goes to work. He then loots the English castles, but all around Britain, France, all the way down into southern France. And this didn't help. They went pretty far inland. They fell upon the exposed coastline. They would loot towns, loot monasteries several miles inland, long way inland, But they didn't stay. They simply took the loot and went home. They were very fierce people. And, of course, as you know, Eric the Red, you know, was supposed to come to America, probably did. They got to the American coastline during this period. And, by the way, for hundreds of years, this was a fear. There was no English prayer. God, it was a formal prayer that was said in the church regularly, protect us from the fury of the Northmen. They were very fierce people. And the threat of the Northmen was ultimately removed only by the conversion of the Scandinavian countries later on. They were never defeated militarily. They were sort of, and by the way, the Scandinavian countries have always been a good giant step behind the rest of Europe in civilization. For instance, Christianity has never amounted to a hill of beans in the Scandinavian countries. We're going to see later when we get to the history of Protestantism that the Roman Catholic Church, they were Christian or even Roman Catholic in name only. Then they became Lutheran in name only. And by the way, it helps us to understand why, for instance, the countries in the world which have led the way in moral freedom, in pornography, in unlicensed sex, are the Scandinavian countries. Still are, by the way. Famous Swedish film stars, you know. Nudity came to the films through the Scandinavian countries. And we look now at what develops in when they. So the last attempt as the Roman Empire died its last, made its last gasp, as it went out of the picture, the Merovingian dynasty, the Merovingian Empire, or the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne, Charles the Great, this was an attempt to replace the Roman Empire. And by the way, I'm giving you the big picture now. We're gonna meet the Holy Roman Empire again. I'm gonna talk about it more systematically. But it was an attempt that did not work, and I'll leave it there because we're gonna talk more about it later. What developed in Europe in the 8th and 9th centuries as during the period of the Holy Roman Empire and as it faded, was a system called feudalism. The system, as I point out, reflected a vast number of bargains and arrangements between private individuals forced by the failure of the central government. Frankish government was a theory rather than a functioning system, and even that collapsed. Land became the only source of wealth. You see, what would you do, you see, if you didn't have land? If the money failed, if you were dependent upon yourself, to feed yourself and to defend yourself in a very barbarian society, if people were going to survive, they had to work out some kind of deal, form a team, form a club, pull together. Would we not do that? It's inevitable. Left by yourself, you'll die. You won't make it. But then you have. But what about those who? See, who had the power then? Those who owned the land, who had the land, including the church. Well, what about the fellow? What about the fellow that doesn't have any land? What's he going to do? Well, what happened was that those who had nothing worked out a deal. This evolved into eventually became a system called feudalism. Those who didn't have anything worked out a deal with those who did. Or as simple as that. The poor citizens sank to the lowest possible level. But landowners evolved into an aristocratic nobility. Look at the nobility of Europe, the art of heraldry, the ancient, coat of arms. It all goes back, if you could trace it long enough, it would go back to these people who, in these centuries that Rome was falling, ended up with the land. And therefore an aristocracy developed. But because it was a wild, barbarian society, a class of independent warriors emerged. Professional soldiers, as it were, to protect. The soldiers assumed the role of a vassal to the Lord. He furnished armor, horse, and board, and in return the soldier defended the manor. So now whereas before, in the high civilization of the Mediterranean world and the East, for centuries, whereas thousands of years before this, 2,000 or 3,000 years before this, you had great cities. You had urban society. You still have them in many places. In the West, it's back to the farm, back to the country. And the central institution is not the town now, it's the manor, which eventually becomes, in many cases, a castle. And life evolves around it. It is rural, it is agrarian, as I say here. And I developed a theory to help hold this together. The early Middle Ages recognized three great classes which sort of came out of this crumbling world, and each had co-defined roles, and by the way, the church oversaw this. There was a clergy. Their job was to pray for and see to the salvation of their fellow men. But these manors eventually had their own chapels, had their own clergymen, their own priests, private clergymen. There were the nobles. They were to defend the helpless and keep order. Quite often they, no one defended the helpless, but they attacked the helpless. But anyway, that was the theory. And then there were the peasants and artisans, those who worked the land and those who could make bread and those who could shoe horses, make simple household objects. They were to provide the necessities of life for the whole of society and luxuries for the clergy and the nobility. That is, you had the clergy, the nobility, and then you had... and by the way, the job of the nobles was to defend, and I said the nobles were to defend the helpless and keep order, and the soldiers worked for them, the knights later on. The clergy, the nobles, and the peasants, and the nobles using their hired army, and it was the job of the clergy to get everybody to heaven. It was the job of the noble to defend the whole, make the system work, to oversee it. It was the job of the peasant to feed everybody. And in case they were attacked, to take up whatever weapon he could get and fight. But only in emergency. So he was to fight only when things really got bad. We look at the relationship between the Lord and the... Is this making sense to you all? Good. It's very difficult to get a hold of. And I'm trying to just deal with it in such broad principles that we can see basically what's going on. We look at... Yes. Well, this worked. No, by the way, the feudal system worked. We're going to see this very well. That is, all things being considered. Look at the lord and the peasant. The inhabitants of the villages who worked in the fields were members of the peasant class and received this land from the lord of the manor. There were degrees of poverty. Those who worked the land, there were basically three groups of these. There were the villeins, or serfs. We get our word villain from this, by the way. They were bound to the land. They were owned just as much as the dirt was owned and the farm tools were owned. There were free tenants, those who were peasants, but they were not bound under some pre-obligation. They could move around, didn't very much, but they could. And then there were the slaves, and the Roman institution did not end until the Middle Ages, well into the Middle Ages. So you had villains or serfs, free tenants, and slaves. The contract between the lord and the peasant was unwritten, but it was hereditary. That is, your parents were peasants, and if you were a villain, you were bound to a land, your children were bound to that land. You went with the real estate. What did the Lord owe to the peasant? I'll just list it here. He owed the peasant physical protection, a court for legal recourse. He owed him a mill, common mill, where he could grind his grain into bread for his family. He owed him a blacksmith shop. He sponsored that. He had his tools fixed and his animals shod. A common oven, where it was fired up once a day and they could bake the day's bread or a couple of days' supply of bread. He owed him a church and a clergyman. And he owed him a bit of individual land, sort of a private garden. He could raise some of his own foodstuffs, although the land legally remained in possession of the Lord. But he theoretically could not claim its produce. That is, theoretically, the peasant was supposed to have a piece of ground and the Lord had no part in it. He couldn't take any of it. That was for his family. I didn't always do that, but that was the... And then he provided common land that was farmed. And I list here, by the way, on the overhead, you got a copy of it in your syllabus. Look how this arrangement was worked out. They did not divide up like a checkerboard. You can see how the feudal system would work. They could not divide it like a checkerboard, because had they done that, impose a grid upon the land and divide it up among the peasants. So you work this, you live here, you work this. Couldn't do that. They didn't live on the land.
the lord of the manor lived in the castle, or the manor house, sometimes the castle. The peasants lived in the village. They would take land that was near a well, but land that was rocky, that was not very productive, and they would live on that. Everybody, and then the, but then they, and there was a common pasture for all their animals, and then they divide the land up in strips, long sections, like this. And they would all work part of it. And the value of this is, see, if they just imposed a grid upon it, then you would get one man,
his square would have good land. Another man might get nothing but rocky hills. Another man might get a swamp. So it was
divided into long sections, sometimes only miles, narrow strips. So the land that was given, this common land that was given to this peasant to work,
it might be 30 or 40 yards wide, but a quarter of a mile long or more. So that way that worked out, he got some good land and bad land. It was fair that way. You see that, how they do that? So that these would just cut across the less productive sections in a way that gave everybody sort of a fair chance, at least in theory. Well, the peasant, so he would live in the village, you can see here, he would live in the village, and he would go out and work his strip of land during the day. Come back to the village at night. His wife could use the oven. He could take his tools to the blacksmith shop. There was a village, there was a church. Now, what he owed, first of all, what the peasant owed the Lord, he owed what we call boom works. That is, he had to work the Lord's land so many days a year. You see, some of these strips of land, that was his land to work. Okay? Then there was a whole section that belonged to the Lord of the manor. A good chunk of it, sometimes a fourth. And all of that, all the produce of the Lord's, the maize is called, went to the Lord of the manor. So the peasant would work so many days a year on the land belonging to the Lord, who owned the land. He would have to pay rent on the strip of land that was his. He usually paid this in produce. And he had to make payments for the use of the mill and the great common oven, a tax. He had to pay the heriot, which was a fee paid at the death of a tenant to renew the hereditary contract, and the merced, which is a fee paid by the unfree tenant if his daughter married outside the manor and thus deprived the lord of one of his serfs. You can review that. And as you might guess, the peasants stayed peasants. There wasn't any way to get out of it. And the Lord ended up did better. So that the peasant would have his piece of ground, but he had to pay rent on that. His house was in the bargain. Then part of the year, so many days a year, he would work the land that belonged to the Lord. He got none of that. He just donated that work. Well, as you can guess, life was not very great for the peasant. You get the general picture? It was a sort of a works arrangement. But in return, you see, it was the responsibility of the Lord to protect him from roving bands of crooks, and there were many of them. I indicated here that life was short and uncertain. People in this day, peasant and lord, soldier alike, were threatened by disease, died of almost everything, nature, and human brutality and avarice. Roving bands of thieves made travel dangerous. What would happen today in Florida if all of a sudden there were no police force? You just have to form a vigilante. People had to bind themselves together and form a private police force, vigilante, to protect ourselves, to stay alive. And so there were roving bands of thieves, professional thieves, sometimes very large bands. Avaricious nobles, ravaged pilgrims, looted villages and monasteries. Sometimes a noble would want to, he didn't like the idea that somebody in the next county would have more land than he had, so he'd just get his soldiers together and attack them and take over, add those lands to his estate. Happened regularly. In time of peace, the nobles were often a little better than the thieves and brigands. In time of war, they were usually worse. That is, see, whether the brigands got you, the crooks got you, whether just a neighboring nobleman got you, making a difference. You were got anyway. I put here in the syllabus a description from the Chanson de Lorraine, which is the song of the Chanson in song, One of the primary sources of one of the primary windows into culture at this time, and he this is a contemporary account of what happened, what could happen almost any day in this feudal system. They start to march. The scouts and the incendiaries. Who are incendiaries? What's an incendiary? Yeah, it's his job to set things on fire. The torch man. And the incendiaries lead. After them came the foragers who are to gather the spoils and carry them to the great baggage train. The tumult begins. The peasants, having just come out of the fields, turn back, uttering loud cries. The shepherds gather their flocks and drive them towards the neighboring woods in the hope of saving them. The incendiaries set the villages on fire, and the foragers visit to sack them. The distracted inhabitants are burned or led apart with their hands tied to be held for ransom. Everywhere alarm bells ring. Fear spreads from side to side and becomes general. On all sides, one sees helmets shining, pennons floating, and horsemen carry those flags they would carry to try to keep the troops together. Pennons floating and horsemen covering the plain. Here hands are laid on money, there cattle, donkeys and flocks are seized. The smoke spreads, the flames rise, the peasants and the shepherds in consternation flee in all directions. After the campaign is over, windmills no longer turn, chimneys no longer smoke. The cocks have ceased their crowing and the dogs their barking. Briars and thorns grow where villages stood of old. And this is an eyewitness account. If you ever wrote this, Ben had seen this happen probably several times. And you see, who attacked? Well, sometimes they were just roving bands of thieves, sort of a feudal system without land, a fella, and others it would be warring nobles who would take their armies and their peasants and attack another manner. Famines occurred regularly. French chronicles, for example, record 48 famine years in the 11th century, and these people died. Epidemics, insects were a common, constant plague, and probably the church had a regular liturgy for anathematizing and excommunicating them. The insects got too bad to have a church service, and they would anathematize the grasshoppers and the fleas and send them to hell, consign them to hell. Well, they said that, that was the... Well, didn't have Orkin back then. What are you going to do? Did it work? No. But made him feel better. I mean, at least if that bug bites you, at least you know he's going to go to hell. Well, this was an age when that was considered normal. It was considered a theological age. What were the physical conditions of the peasantry? Housing was, quote, as one historian put it, poverty unadorned. Most of us wouldn't keep a dog in the places that the people lived, the average peasant lived in. And the lord of the manor wasn't much better. Food was brown bread, oatmeal porridge, or boiled peas, and water or whey. Whey is what's left over in all the butterfats taken out of milk. Today it's called low-fat milk. You pay extra for it. We look at the castle. The site was chosen for defensibility on a hilltop or a promontory island. By the way, you still go to Europe today, you still see these. They're very on any place that's high ground, defensible. If they couldn't find an island, they'd make one. That's what the moat is. And some castles in Europe are on islands. Others have moats around them, artificial islands. Yes. Yes. Any place that's defensible. Yeah, we're just a handful of men that could hold off a lot of others. See, when these manors developed into castles, when the enemy attacked, everybody run for the castle, pull up the drawbridge, and hold them off. They made sure they had a well inside. They had provisions stored up. Sometimes it took years for the enemy to go away. Not very often, but sometimes. The feudal castle, what was it like inside? It was dark. That says camp. It should be damp. Dark, damp, dirty, inconvenient, flea-bitten, lousy, and boring. It was terrible. There was a great vaulted hall in the center. That was the center of activity. It would have a huge fireplace, which was very inefficient. They burned logs 8 and 10 feet long. And they had rooms, interesting, they had rooms attached to the fireplace. They're on the ends of it that were warm. That's where the scribes would sit, keep their records, you know, they'd sit all day. They would often sit, you often read about the literature, people sitting in the fireplace. I think it says, remember, I think in the original story of Cinderella, her room was in the fireplace. You wondered how anybody would live in a fireplace. What they meant was it built into this, there were little rooms at either end of it. It would be heated through by convection through the walls, and there are actually rooms in the fireplace. The dogs had huge dogs, watchdogs, very common, and nobody ever cleaned anything. They put rushes on the floor, weeds on the floor, in order to try to make it a little bit more tolerable. Then they'd become full of fleas, and once in a while they would have to clean them out. What was the intellectual condition of the peasants? Totally uneducated, grossly superstitious, exceedingly immoral. Morals were almost non-existent. And the lords of the manor were usually not better off, and sometimes the clergy was no better. The clergy, the only place, generally speaking, with some exceptions, but generally speaking, the only place you'd find literature and culture learning would be in the monasteries. Sometimes in the local clergy, but not very often. By and large, the local clergyman was just about like everybody else. Maybe a little better, sometimes worse. By the way, you read some of the literature comes out of this period. It is exceedingly crude. Their humor, their songs, their customs were very rowdy, just dirty. They were just a dirty, ignorant people. In other words, all kinds of songs and stories come out of this period, which were just downright pornographic. Very low moral. This brings us to the church in the West, and we got 4 minutes left. Let me start there. I'm not finished yet. Let me start there, because it starts kind of a new discussion next time we meet, the expansion of the church. Let me make a few more comments in the time we have left on medieval society. It's very difficult for us to grasp what is going on. I've tried to describe it in terms of sort of the best arrangement that people could make under the circumstances. No sources of learning, very few sources of everything was basically bartered. Gold was like gold and silver. You could trade gold and silver, and there was some local money. But especially in the early Middle Ages, in the early part of the Dark Ages, life was very cheap. And innocent, but it wasn't true all over the world. It is during this period that we need to understand that life and culture and literature and learning in the East and in Northern Africa and in Spain, where the countries were Muslim, that the Muslims looked upon the Christians, and the Christians they knew were really the society which had become dominated by the Franks. These Europeans, the Muslims looked down their nose at them, and they had every right to. You've got to realize that the Muslim culture in this period was far advanced as far as literature, learning, morals, than the Christian culture, than Christendom. We used to think of the Muslims as being a bunch of, you look at Iran today, we look down our nose at them, some of their ways of doing things, but I think is the other way around. And so that you have, by the way, and we're going to see later that high scholasticism, for instance, an attempt to return to learning, came as a reaction to, as a response to what the Muslims were doing. Yes?
What does medieval mean?
Medieval simply means a middle age. It's Latin.
Does it have
medieval in there? No. Middle is, it's Latin for middle age, middle ages. We call them Middle, by the way, they're called Middle Ages, of course, because they're between Rome and the Renaissance. In the middle, between Rome, the fall of Rome began the Middle Ages, the Renaissance and the rise of nations ends the Middle Ages. One of the reasons they're called Middle Ages is because you can't hang out, they're just sort of there. They're not, you don't have any great nation, any great empire, local feudalism, it's the Dark Age. Question about this. Are you getting the general picture of what's going on? Yes. The feudal system was, it's a good question, where it was. The feudal system was, it was Italy, it was southern Germany, south of the Rhine, and extended up north into it later on. It was Gaul, France, it extended into Britain later with conversion of the Anglo-Saxons.